Hi, I'm Miguel Garcia, creator and host of the Sports as a Weapon podcast, a Chicano sports podcast on the entanglement of sports, radical politics, and working class sports fan culture. We talk just sports too. Subscribe and listen to the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. You can also listen to the podcast on Amazon Music, Deezer, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Pandora. Follow the podcast on Twitter at Sports as a Weapon and on Instagram and Facebook at Sports as a Weapon Podcast. Or visit our website at www.sportsasaweapon.com.
Hey, this is Dave Zirin, and you are listening to the Sports as a Weapon Podcast. Hey, this is Dave Zirin, and you are listening to the Sports as a Weapon podcast.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Sports as a Weapon podcast, a Chicano sports podcast on the entanglement of sports, radical politics, and working class sports fan culture. And don't worry, we talk about just sports, too. So on this week's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Jose Alamillo. He's a professor at Cal State University, Channel Islands. He is a cultural historian who teaches and writes about immigration, labor, race, gender, leisure, and sport. And today I'm going to talk to him about his book, Deportes, The Making of a Sporting Mexican Diaspora. Hello, Dr. Alamillo. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Miguel, for hosting me. I've been looking forward to this conversation with you.
Awesome. I've been looking forward to it too. It was a great book. I'm really excited because I'm going to be using it as a reference for my little Chicano sports history segments.
Oh, that's great.
There's a lot of good info on there. So yeah, so thank you for that book. It's going to be a great resource for me for my podcast too.
I love the name of your podcast. I've been looking for a sports podcast just like yours. So I'm happy to be part of it now.
Thank you. Thank you. I know there's a couple kind of like mine, but I wanted to make it a little Chicano, you know, spin to it, even though it's not just about Chicano sports. But since I'm a Chicano and I haven't really seen any podcasts that kind of center that. So that was kind of another reason, because when I started it, I didn't put that in my little intro, but figured no one's doing that. So I should. I'm really glad to have you on here because there's a lot of good Mexican and Chicano history in your book. So very excited to talk to you today. And if you want, tell the audience a little about yourself.
Yeah, so I was born in Mexico, in Zacatecas, and I lived there until I was about 7 years old and came here to reunite with my family. They had left previously, so I was left with my grandparents and for about 2 years. And, you know, my grandfather was a big boxing fan, so he would take me to, you know, boxing matches, and he would listen to the radio, baseball, you know, on, you know, so I grew up with sort of this strong association with sports, you know, if not playing them, then listening to them or watching them. And even to this day, you know, our family gets together around sports, whether it's Little League games, you know, or soccer matches, or just watching boxing on Saturday nights. And we have this tradition, the quiniela, you know, the quiniela, the gambling tradition, where we pass
around
that. We bet.
Really, boxing matches before the boxing match.
That's right. Right. And so I grew up with, you know, with sort of that family sports kind of being really interconnected, right? And so I didn't really think about writing about it because most of my early work was really looking at labor, immigration, but I was always interested in the, you know, cultural dimensions around labor, around immigration, and also about thinking about what people did outside of work, right? And it really started with interviews, you know, just, you know, I think at some point people just they didn't want to talk about work and, you know, how difficult it was and how low paying it was and how backbreaking it was. And they wanted to talk about sports. They wanted to talk about their baseball home runs that they hit, you know, their victories and their favorite athletes. And so I'm like, all right, let's go there.
So you already were like a big sports fan and like sports had an impact on your life growing up. But this, I guess, idea kind of came, I don't know, by accident while you're just, you know, talking, interviewing these people about your other work, your research.
That's right.
Pretty cool. They're like, let's talk about something fun.
and I think it was this sort of desire for people to see themselves more in a holistic way, right? That they were tired of being viewed and portrayed as just another cheap laborer, right? Which, you know, that's it in the media. The popular imagination is that that's all we're about, right? Labor, arms, braceros. We're just here for backbreaking work. And I think there is also this kind of internalized notion of the Mexican work ethic that we're hard workers, and then but that is used against us as well, right? And I think we're tired of that, right? Of course we have to work, but our life is much more fuller and it's much more complex. You know, we do take time to enjoy life, to do physical activity, take part in any kind of sports related event, whether it's watching, coming together. We have family reunions at Dodger Stadium. You know, we love to watch, you know, the World Cup every 4 years as a family, right? So I think that there's definitely that is part of family, right? That when we think about our Mexican families, my Mexican family, and that's kind of what we're about. You know, we get together on these very sports events, and we continue to do that, right? To cheer for our favorite athletes.
I know for me growing up, I think baseball was one of the big sports for me and my family. Like I remember watching a lot of boxing too, but it was usually going over to other relatives' houses who had the fight. And like you said earlier, you know, you would have that game where you bet on the rounds of who's going to get it right, put some money in. So I remember doing that growing up. And I also remember, which actually you mentioned in your book, you mentioned the fight between Oscar de la Hoya and Julio Cesar Chavez.
Oh, yeah.
You're probably talking about the first one, but I remember that growing up. I was a little kid. I was like 9, 10, 11 years old. I can't remember right now, but I remember all the older adults going for Julio Cesar Chavez, and I think my dad was too. And even though I knew who he was and I was a fan of his, I went with Oscar de la Hoya because I was, you know, I was raised here in the U.S., so I kind of went with that, I guess, that Chicano point of view. And I guess that Chicano, I picked the Chicano pretty much, which at the time I didn't think of myself as a Chicano. I don't even think I knew what Chicano was. But I guess identifying with the Mexican boxer that closely resembled more of me, because I grew up in Southern California. No, I wasn't born in Mexico. Whereas my dad, he actually was born in the U.S., but it was by accident. And both my parents were born in the fields over there in Hollister, while my grandparents were working in the Bracero program. And then they ended up moving to Mexico when they're babies. So they grew up their childhood in Mexico. So it was kind of also like he grew up here in the U.S. after he was like 12, but he still, you know, considered he went with the Mexican from Mexico when he's picking the fighter.
Right.
So that's another interesting thing within our culture.
It is.
And sports. Know.
Exactly. I mean, I didn't even know that even my grandfather had lived here in the U.S. during his young, you know, early adult years, from, you know, when he was in his 20s. And he would tell me stories about his favorite boxer, Bert Colima, you know, that he would go and watch him in L.A. And I'm like, what? You know, I'm like, yeah, I mean, then he went back in the 30s during the Great Depression, right, to then start a family in Mexico. But, you know, I think that sort of memories that he brought with him and that he shared with me were really about sports as well, and his fascination with these sports heroes, right? And for him, one of his early sports heroes was Bert Colima. You know, not a lot of people know who he is, but, you know, he was from Whittier, you know, California. yet he went and he fought all over the Southwest and in Mexico, right? He ends up winning the Mexican middleweight championship and he becomes this hero to the Mexican nation. He's, you know, received by the president. And so he's like this sort of important boxing sports star in Mexico, but also in LA, right? So you have this early on, this sort of transnational back and forth movement of athletes. You know, they're going to go where those opportunities emerge. And that's what they did, is they went to Mexico to fight.
Yeah, so I'm going to ask you about boxing in a little bit, but kind of related to this whole transnationalism across borders. Mm-hmm. What role did the YMCA in the promotion of American ideology of muscular Christianity have on the development of sports in Mexico and the sporting Mexican diaspora? And then what was Mexico de Afuera?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, sets up shop in Mexico City, you know, and I visited the collection at the University of Minnesota where they have an incredible, huge collection on there. And I was really surprised in my research just finding how much they promoted sports, and in particularly basketball, right? That was a big sport that they were, you know, of course they were the ones that founded basketball in the U.S., but they also promoted boxing, you know, track and field, bowling, you know, all kinds of other sports. But, you know, they ran into a problem in Mexico.
Okay.
You know, the Catholic Church was like, don't even dare go into the YMCA, so you're not going to be allowed to come back to church. And so they, what they did, their strategy was then to use sports as a way to bring in the young adults into their association. And so they use physical education programs to really inculcate this muscular Christianity, right? This idea that, you know, Jesus Christ was the fit man, he was rugged, and he had success, right? Both in his physical development, but also in his spiritual leadership, right? So they wanted to teach the young Mexican men, right, not only, you know, physical activity, but also Bible study. So they would have these, like, programs where they would combine both, right? And it was a way to Americanize them, also to teach them English, to learn, you know, Christianity and so forth. And while some of them did do that, they used it to their own advantage, right? Because mm-hmm. they were able to then gain some leadership opportunities. They would end up being trained by the YMCA school in Springfield, Illinois, right, to become a leader, right, what they call supervisor, a YMCA secretary, and sort of like a manager within the YMCA branches all over the world, right? And those were leadership opportunities that many of them took on. And but also, you know, participating in kind of gymnastics and other related sports through the YMCA.
I thought it was very interesting reading about that muscular Christianity, because I already kind of knew about that a little bit. And then when I think of that word, and that first thing I see in my head is, I don't know if people have seen The Simpsons, but they have Flanders, and there's been a couple episodes where he's like all buff. And that's exactly what I think of as a muscular Christianity, is I think of Flanders from The Simpsons. That was just another project by America when it comes to assimilating other cultures, right? And so with the racial project.
Right, right.
Speaking of racism, what was the Mexican problem and the role it played in the sporting Mexican diaspora? Which, I guess, throughout the book, you kind of talk about the Mexican problem in different eras. But I know you also talk about it in these early times in Mexico.
Well, it started with a lot of the American writers going into Mexico, right? And then...
Okay.
And doing these sort of travelogues and then writing about Mexican society. And they would always write about it in a very derogatory way. Like, you know, these Mexicans are primitive, they're backward, uncivilized, childlike. And so these ideas then get communicated back to the U.S. because, I mean, they're publishing mm-hmm. works in English, right? So guess who's reading them? Educators, you know, leaders, politicians. And then so basically what happens then is in the U.S., these nativist restrictionists towards immigration begin to read these books, and they're like, well, we need to, you know, keep Mexicans out. We need to find ways to change immigration law and policy. So essentially that what emerges is the Mexican problem, right? In the press, in the media, you know, they really push these racial stereotypes that are being applied to the Mexican physical body, right, as being physically unfit, right? They're unhealthy. They're bad hygiene. And so basically that then gets, you know, transferred to sports and physical play, right? Because, you know, then you have these studies that were done in the 1920s by these eugenists, right? This is sort of scientific racism where they would actually rank races according to physical fitness, believe it or not. And so you have this publication in one of the magazines or journals called American Physical Education Review that actually published, you know, studies on this idea that, you know, some races are just not physically fit to play certain sports. And of course, you see then Mexicans being at the lower level of, you know, physical readiness. And so that idea then becomes popularized among physical coaches, physical activity coaches, you know, PE coaches in schools. And so they you know, are essentially looking at Mexicans as, oh, they need to be supervised. They have hot temper. They don't know the rules of the game. They need to be taught how to play. And they need to be also taught how to be disciplined in terms of that particular sport, right? And so these are ideas that are widely disseminated and published in journals and master's thesis. And so you have one of the most famous of them, Emery Borgadas, who is a sociologist at USC, who's like supervising all these master's theses. And so he's railing against boxing as being very uncivil and very, you know, dangerous for Mexican boys. And so he's basically pushing for the banning of boxing because it shouldn't be taught to Mexican boys. But, you know, they're not going to listen to him, right? They're going to continue, you know, in backyards, boxing. You're going to have, you know, matches in their backyards. You know, so you have, again, these what you call physical educators, physical education educators and physical reformists trying to kind of assimilate the Mexican boy or immigrant into these particular types of American sports and not others, right? Because the preferred sport, of course, was baseball, right? That's the national after all.
Yeah, and I just thought it was so interesting because I believe you also mentioned a historian, Dr. Molina's racial scripts. Yeah, and so I use that in actually my anthropology master's research too for my research. But yeah, it's very interesting how you talk about all these racial scripts that keep getting applied throughout those decades up to even like the 70s with like Pancho Gonzalez, the tennis player. And it all starts from, I guess, when you start the book at this time in the 20s and
30s. That's right. That's right. And you can even see this to this day, right? When you think about the racial scripts, even to this day, right, they continue, you know, yeah, I think, you know, Professor Molina's work is really important, you know, in thinking about how Mexican immigrants are, you know, portrayed and then viewed and then treated, right? Because these are, again, these racial frames that are in people's heads, but that extends to the sporting world as well. When you think about how certain athletes are viewed as, you know, potential invaders, you know, well, we need to keep them out, right? So they, you know, they apply that script to Mexican boxers who were viewed as taking the jobs of white American boxers. So they actually held them at the border. You know, in the case of the two that I talk about, you know, baby Rodolfo Casanova and Luis Villanueva, Kid Azteca, right? They were literally held at the border because they were, you know, considered a threat to the white American boxers, you know, and again, you know, this is the '20s, right? When you had this push to, essentially make boxing white again, right? They were looking for the white savior in boxing because
the great white hope.
That's right. The great white hope, right? Because they had exiled, you know, Jack Johnson, right, to Mexico. And so they succeeded in sort of banning blacks in boxing. But now it's like, oh, we have these Mexicans coming across the border. What are we going to do about them? Are we going to ban them too? Well, not so fast. They attempted, but ultimately were unsuccessful.
Me, I'm not super huge. Like, I like boxing, but I'm not a big fanatic when it comes to the other sports. So I know about these boxers, but I didn't know about these incidents. And this is, you know, back then in the 20s or 30s. And the same thing is obviously happening now. You could even connect it to now. Mexicans and Central Americans are just migrating and white people, nativists, right wingers are always saying, oh, well, they're taking our jobs, they're taking our jobs. And this is the same thing that we're doing here, but in terms of, you know, sports of boxing, that we're taking the white boxers' jobs here.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, also why I wrote the book, I was really getting tired of the rhetoric that was in the media, especially when Trump came to office, right? And, you know, it's all negativity. I mean, why is it that Trump can get away with saying what he did? Well, because Mexicans are not at the table and they're not part of the conversation about who are the Mexican people, who are the Mexican athlete. And I wanted to understand historically what has been the role of the Mexican athlete and its contribution to this country, right? But not just to this country, but to Mexico itself, right? That when we think about, you know, the Mexican athlete, we tend to think about Fernando Valenzuela, right? Or, you know, some of the boxers like Canelo, right? And that has always been the case. We've had, you know, athletes of Mexican descent way back in the early 20th century, and yet we know very little about them, right? Especially how they contribute to the sports world, right? And how also they were not just representing their community, but they were also representing Mexico, right? And mm-hmm. in ways that is really important, right, to shed a different light, a more positive light on Mexican athletics, Mexicans' contributions to the sports world. So I really wanted to counter that narrative, you know, that was out there.
And that's what they called Mexico de Afuera, right?
Yeah, right. So that idea of Mexico de Afuera, right, is this idea that, you know, when immigrants were displaced, both because of economics or because of political reasons, they come to the U.S., right? But they're coming to the U.S. not so much to assimilate into American society, right? They're going to continue to practice their own Mexicanidad, right? They're going to work hard, but also they're not going to necessarily, you know, stay here perhaps permanently. At least that was the thinking, right? They were going to maybe here be temporarily. But of course, that may change given that, U.S.-born children may want to stay, right? But really, they were about ensuring that their children would not forget about their homeland, right? And they wouldn't be forgotten. And so they use sports, right, as a way to represent that Mexicanidad. And the best example of that is how when you think about team names, right, even to this day, we have names that are named after their hometowns, right, from where they came in Latin America, or just even representing the nation, right? So you have a lot of team names, you know, with like representing Mexico, like Mexico El Paso, which is one of the baseball teams in the 30s. But you even had, boxers taking on the term Mexico, right? In fact, you had this white Irish boxer who renamed himself Kid Mexico.
Because
Mexican becomes really important in the sport of boxing, right?
He appropriated it that quick.
Exactly. Were the early appropriations of Mexico, right?
Yeah.
But he was doing that in the 20s, right? At the same time, we see the rise of the Mexican problem. Within the sporting world, it was a little different, right? There was this Mexican vogue. There was this fascination with Mexican boxers. In fact, they want to import them into the sporting venues like Olympic Auditorium or Hollywood Legion Stadium because, you know, they were moneymakers. I mean, they would fill the seats. So here's where you had in the boxing world, boxing promoters saying, we want Mexicans to come in. And so they were pushing back against this nativist, right?
It was mostly because they liked the money and they're like, oh, okay,
exactly.
Mexicans are making us money, so hey.
Yep, that's
it's
right.
Kind of a early woke capitalism as well, but it also benefited us as Mexicans because we got to showcase our sporting skills.
Well, yeah, I mean, you definitely didn't see them be the owners of these venues, right?
That's true. Yeah,
but they became matchmakers. They were there were some that became boxing promoters, you know, trainers, right? We know them, so they were some positions where they're able to move up, but not becoming sort of the owners of these particular sports, right? In a big way, right? You had some venues, right, that are allowing them not to come in and, you know, set up matches or, you know, bring in teams from Mexico, right? So, for example, in White Sox Park, that becomes a really important space, right, for, you know, the baseball promoters, right? Because they were bringing in literally teams from Mexico then to compete with local teams, right? And so that becomes an important job, right, that they're able to obtain.
Yeah, so can you talk about, you know, Mexicans throughout Southern California and the Southwest were forming baseball and softball teams.
Yeah,
you know. They eventually created the Mexican Baseball League of Southern California. And as you said, they were playing at this prominent park, White Sox Park. Can you talk about the whole culture of their of baseball?
Yeah, well, you know, most people know about the Negro Leagues, right?
Mm-hmm.
They know a lot about, you know, the importance of the Negro Leagues, but very few people know about the Mexican Baseball Leagues in Southern California. We had a huge league system emerging early on in the early 1900s. 1920s in particular was the boom period, right? This is where the roaring 20s, but it was also, right, the golden age sports, right? And the Mexican community had their own golden age as well. They were forming baseball leagues. And many of them that were forming these leagues were associated with newspapers. So there were, some of them were journalists in the Spanish language newspapers like La Opinión.
Okay.
Some of them were business owners. So they had maybe a shoe store. They were, you know, basically sponsoring a team. And so these leagues were really prominent. In fact, if you look at the standings, the baseball standings in newspapers, you would find not just the, you know, the Major League Baseball standings, right? But you would also see the Mexican Baseball League standings in the region. And they were really huge because that's who their heroes were. That was who their sports heroes were in towns like Colton, Corona,
mm-hmm.
Anaheim, you name it. In all these cities, they had the team that was the top, you know, and the best. And then they would then play across teams in other counties. And so you had this network, which became really important because they use that network not just for, you know, playing the most competitive teams, but also as a network for jobs, right? A network for social capital, a network for also, you know, extending their network outside of their immediate area and allow them to travel, allow them to see other communities, you know, ultimately maybe, you know, moving there or, you know, finding, you know, a wife or a spouse, right? Because these baseball leagues, right, ultimately led to marriages, you know? So you definitely did have this kind of alternative baseball league emerging in Southern California that becomes really crucial to forming the, you know, kind of a social network that becomes really important, especially for them to survive, right, through the Depression and then ultimately to, you know, use it to their own political advantage. And I do talk about how they become politicized, right? These networks, because it's not just about survival, right? Sometimes it's like, okay, we need to do something about this, you know, and when the political issues arise, right? Whether it's the issue of racial discrimination, the issue of not enough, you know, resources from the city going towards recreation, sports leagues and so forth, right? They're going to push the city, right, to, you know, respond and to increase the support and those resources. So they're going to activate, right, these networks when it's necessary.
Yeah, I thought that was one of my favorite things about reading about this network of and this baseball league, that the whole Mexican community throughout Southern California and then, you know, across borders to Mexico, they connected. I just thought it was interesting how they were using sport as pretty much what my podcast is about, is sport as a weapon.
As a weapon, right.
They were using it as a tool. Like, it was, yes, they wanted to play and do all this because they like baseball. They also used it for political reasons. And I remember reading in your book, even when someone maybe got in an accident or died, people would have fundraisers through this baseball community mm-hmm. to help those families. Mm-hmm. And it was also, it's just another reflection of how Mexican culture is with familia and family.
That's right.
So I thought it was really cool, especially because baseball is just, baseball and basketball are my favorite sports. And I would say baseball, though, had a little bigger impact when it comes with my culture and sports.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really cool reading and learning about that. And then I read a little bit before about Colton having that history being from there. Mm-hmm. So it was really cool just seeing all the different little neighborhoods, cities, barrios, colonias mm-hmm. having baseball teams.
Well, I mean, Colton is really important because you had, you know, Correon there, you had the Mercuries, and you had the ballpark, right? And when you think about ballparks, right, we don't think about it as these spaces of solidarity and organizing, but that's where they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when there was a strike, guess where the gathering place was? The ballpark, because that was the largest space where they can gather. But more importantly, that was the most safest space because no police or strike break, or, you know, or employer may think, oh, they're just, you know, playing baseball, right? So it's safe to talk among themselves in the space where, you know, they couldn't really do that in a union hall or in the workplace, right? Mm-hmm. And so it becomes an organizing space when there's a strike, right? So that is as a weapon right there, ballparks.
Yeah, and can you talk about a ballpark in Los Angeles, South Central, I believe, was White Sox Park?
Yeah.
How that was important to this whole, I guess, movement of baseball within the Mexican community throughout SoCal.
Yeah, no, White Sox Park is really important. You know, this is a ball, what most people know about, you know, Wrigley Field and, mm-hmm. you know, but very few people know about White Sox Park because it was just down the street on 38th Street and Compton Avenue in South LA. Right now, if you pass by, you may see Russ Snyder Recreation Center. And so basically, it was a 7,000 seat park. Okay. But that was the home of the California Winter League. And the Winter League hosted many teams, right? So this park was founded by Italian-American brothers, Joe Pironi and John, his brother John. And so these were like these vegetable wholesale business owners, right? And they founded it in 1924. There was another earlier park in East LA area that was much earlier, but this was the one that the Pironi's owned, and they essentially became a really popular space for not only the Negro League teams, but for also the Mexican-American baseball teams, and as well as the Nisei, Japanese-American League teams. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because when we think about ballparks, right, you know, at one point, ballparks were segregated, right? I mean, they mm-hmm. barred, you know, African-Americans, right? In Wrigley Field, right, did not allow Negro League teams to play there. So they played in White Sox Park. And that's where I think most non-white teams felt at home, right? They actually enjoyed going to White Sox Park also because it was very culturally relevant for them. I mean, you had, you know, Mexican food being sold there. There's this picture in my book about, you know, that tamale cart.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they were selling tamales at the baseball stadium, you know, at White Sox Park. And so, this is where I think you see then a transnational network develop, because it wasn't just local regional teams. We're talking about international teams. So you had Japanese teams from Tokyo coming in and playing in White Sox Park, but you also had, you know, the Azteca from Mexico City coming in, visiting, playing a few exhibition games at White Sox Park. So you had international teams also visiting White Sox Park. So it becomes a really important transnational space.
Yeah, so it wasn't just a transnational space for Mexicans from Mexico and mm-hmm. Southern California and the Southwest. It was also for other ethnicities like Japanese.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
That's really
cool. And then in the 1930s, right, the Pironis realized, like, wow, you know, this is huge, right? So they opened up a new summer league that is run by one of the baseball promoters, the Castillo brothers, right? The Castillo brothers organized the summer league, and this summer league becomes really popular because, you know, they're bringing the best teams from Mexico and the Mexican League, the baseball league, to play with the best teams here locally in Southern California. And they're charging, you know, fees to get in. And so they're, you know, it's becoming a lucrative business, right, during the 1930s.
That was really cool. I had to ask you about White Sox Park because the way I was looking at it, and I had to put my, like, anthropologist lens and spaces and politics and the spatial, like, the importance of this space for not just Mexicans, but for other ethnic cultures, other people, immigrants. So now I want to ask you about how vital was the Mexican Athletic Association of Southern California? What role did the 1932 Olympic Games have in its formation?
Well, it basically was the impetus, right, for the formation of this association. So if it wasn't for the 1932 Olympics, you might not have had this association become as big as it was in the 30s. So it grew, right, from local sports clubs, right, that were already, like, you know, in East LA. You know, you had a lot of small sports clubs that basically would, you know, some of them were like social clubs and then became sports clubs, and then they became, right, from there, then the Mexican Athletic Association kind of becomes the umbrella, right, of all these sports clubs, where they then would then field a team, whether it's in track and field or basketball, right? And they primarily focus on the amateur sports that were not, you know, already, you know, professional, right? So they didn't really get into baseball. They didn't really get into professional boxing. They did have amateur boxing tournaments, but they're primarily focused more on, although it was primarily for men, there were some women that did also participate in the association, primarily in the sport of tennis and basketball. But tennis becomes really big for the local league and basketball league as well for young girls as well. But it really becomes really, to me, the significance of this association is because it becomes a training ground for leadership opportunities, for organization opportunities. You know, you have, for example, the leaders. Juan Acevedo is one of the leaders. And you have Rey Sanchez, another important leader. You know, these are leaders in other areas because not only are they good athletes in the particular sport, but they're also, you know, go on and get an education. They go into, you know, UCLA, USC, right? They're actually opening up opportunities for athletes to get scholarships to go to college and university, which to me was, they saw that need. They saw that there's a gap there and they wanted to push these amateur athletes to continue into college and university. So it was a kind of pipeline for that, for, you know, future, you know, collegiate athletes as well.
So people like Rey Sanchez were using their, I guess, social economic capital to help with the, I guess, cultural capital of the rest of the Mexican Chicano community.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. And not only that, I mean, you had then Pedro Despard using it as for political capital, right? Because he runs for assembly, right? He launched his political campaign, right? Having worked with the, you know, the association and having already made ties with Mexican Sports Association, right? So here you have many of these leaders forging ties with the Mexico Sporting Federation, right? CODEME, right? Confederación Deportiva Mexicana, right? Which then gives them more leverage, right? To be able to say, look, we have connections with Mexican government, right? So we have an extensive network, right? That's transnational and we could use it when we need it. And they did, right? When the city basically, you know, disses them and really just fails to provide any resources or more resources. And then also, you know, does not hire Mexican American athletic trainers and leaders in these many parks, right? They're going to push the city, right, to hire more Mexican Americans. They're going to push the city to give them more resources and also to open up facilities, because that was one of the challenges. They didn't have a lot of facilities to play in, right? And they'd be charged. So I'm like, excuse me, I'm a city resident. Why would I be charged money, right, for this? So they had a lot of beef with the city of Parks and Rec.
And that was the LA Department of Parks and...
It's Parks and Recreation Department, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they used it for political capital, right? Pedro Despard then launches political campaign. Of course, he's unsuccessful. But again, you can kind of see then how this association becomes a training ground for future political leaders as well.
Yeah, and I also thought it was interesting that the word, you know, the term Chicano was starting to be used when it comes to sports. I'm referring to, I think it was boxers mostly. And a lot of people, I don't think, know about that because we always learn, oh, it's the 60s when we start using Chicano more, you know?
No.
But
I think that was one of the findings that I was surprised by, you know, like many surprises I had, you know, in doing this work, is they would use Chicanito, right? In the write-ups of these athletes. Oh, these Chicanitos, they have great potential to be, you know, great athletes, maybe going on to the Olympics. They should get a scholarship, right, for the school. I'm like, yeah. So they were talking about these younger Mexican-American, right, U.S. born and raised in L.A. area as potential future Chicanos, right? Already even using that term in that way, because they need to be cultivated, they need to be nurtured because they have a lot of athletic talent. That's where you see the popularity of Chicano and Chicana being used. And not just even within like track and field, but also in the newspapers, like I talk about Mitch's sports page. And even in that sports page, the term Chicano is used to refer to younger boxers, younger athletes, baseball players as well, right? So yeah, I think that we tend to think about Chicano as more of a politicized term that began with the 60s, right, around, you know, the anti-war, you know, the student walkouts, but we rarely associate that term with sports. But remember, you ever wear those shirts, right? You know, Chicano power? Well, Chicano power in the sports field also, right? You know? I mean, come on, people. Like, we can't just limit it Chicano power, right, to the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Protest, come on. Where is the Chicano power, right? Or Chicana power, right? But it also in the playing field.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things I learned from reading your book. Oh, all right, since I'm a big basketball fan, I want to talk about the sport of basketball and its importance to the development of the sporting Mexican diaspora. You know, in basketball, they don't talk about Mexicans a lot when it comes to basketball. And I thought it was really cool reading more about basketball and Mexicans in your book. I think that little history.
Mm-hmm.
Especially one of the players, Jose Plasencia.
Yep. Plasencia, yeah. And many others. I mean, you know, basketball opens up to Mexican-American women as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we tend to forget that, you know, one of the great labor leaders in Chicana history, Emma Tenayuca, was a damn good basketball player, playing guard, right? She was also
so awesome.
All-star in San Antonio, Texas. Now, I don't mostly talk about Southern California. I didn't go into Texas sports history, but I was just like blown away by how many of these, you know, basketball teams were fielding great, you know, female players that were just amazing athletes. And you know, they were given those opportunities in the sport of basketball. And I thought that was really great because, you know, we don't talk about women in sports a lot. And typically, you know, especially within basketball, right? Because we tend to think about, you know, we talk about the NBA, but we don't talk about the WNBA, right? And so there's definitely that gender double standard when it comes to women's sports. But I think it is important to talk about basketball, you know, as sort of an emerging sport early on. Now, of course, it wasn't as popular as boxing and baseball, but it still had a following that was very grassroots, mm-hmm. very much, you know, centered within the YMCA. Because again, that's where a lot of the great basketball teams would play at the YMCA gym, right? That's where they had the basketball gym and that's where they would play. But they're also kind of emerging as leagues, right? Basketball leagues through the association that I mentioned. And then after the war, right, you have Mexican-American vets, right, becoming a team, right, a basketball team that would play here in Southern California. But, you know, it's just interesting, right, how recently, you know, with Jaimito, right, Jaime Jaquez mm-hmm. Jr., right, UCLA basketball player, right, and how all of a sudden it's like, wow, you know, I didn't know Mexicans play basketball. Yes, we have. We also play basketball.
Yep. And oh, and then especially, like, I know in Oaxaca, basketball is a big, big thing, too, in Mexico. And then just growing up in Southern California, like, I'm Mexican, Chicano, like,
that's right.
A lot of us love basketball. And then I know it has also to do where we grew up and we live in L.A., too. But even in other states where Chicanos and Mexicans live. Like you mentioned, the San Antonio team that I talked about before in an earlier episode with Dr. Frank Gurdy. That was the team in San Antonio that won. You talk about them, too.
Mm-hmm.
That was in Texas. I think it was Lanier High School.
Yeah.
So there's just there's a lot of rich history of Mexicans in basketball, but for some reason, we don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you talk about it because we need to talk about that more.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a great documentary for those that are interested in learning more about, you know, the importance of like basketball in many indigenous communities. You know, A Hawk and Hoops is a great documentary mm-hmm. that I like to show in my classes and I teach about basketball, you know, to say, look, we may have a future Zapotec basketball player joining the NBA. You know, all we need is to nurture that basketball talent here locally, and we may have one, right, emerging. So I think, to me, it's about channeling resources to the young talent
mm-hmm.
and making sure that they continue on to play professionally. You know, like Jaimito, right? I look forward to him, you know, entering professionally in the NBA. But, you know, it shouldn't just be four or very few NBA players of Mexican descent, you know? I mean, come on. We have much more talent that is just waiting to be tapped into, you know?
Which you also talk about in the sport of tennis in your book with legendary Chicano Mexican tennis player that I also think a lot of people don't know about
yep.
is Richard Pancho Gonzalez. Can you talk about that too?
Yeah, Pancho Gonzalez. In fact, it's interesting because, you know, I was never introduced to the sport of tennis, even growing up, right? I mean, come on, think about it. In Mexican families, like, oh, you play what? Tennis? That's a sissy sport. And that's
yeah, it was funny. I actually played it. I actually played it in high school, but it was only, I played football too, but it was just, oh, I'm just going to play tennis for fun. It wasn't like not to be serious on that. Right. And everyone was like, you're playing tennis?
Right.
It's like weird.
Right. And that's his exact reaction that I got too, right? And so that's the exact reaction that Pancho Gonzalez got too from his family and from his, you know, friends. It's like, and you know what I think Pancho Gonzalez brought to the sport of tennis is amazing, because he brought, well, one, masculinity. You know, he brought a lot of hyper masculine, aggressive, you know, style. I mean, he was amazing in this. I mean, not only was his serve one of the most aggressive serves in the sport, but he brought this kind of intimidating factor that a lot of opponents talk about. You know, oh man, they just hated playing Pancho because he was just aggressive. And not only that, but he was intimidating, you know. And but I think, you know, he was getting his aggression out in the court, because he faced a lot of discrimination, you know, early on. You know, he was portrayed as a pachuco, right, because he has a scar on his cheek from an accident. And, you know, all the sports media would, you know, would write about him in a very derogatory, racially, you know, stereotypical way. And you know, his family, his mom in particular, hated that. You know, in fact, his mom even hated the name Pancho, which was the nickname that was given to him. But he was Ricardo Gonzalez. You know, he wasn't Francisco.
Yeah, his name's not Francisco.
Like, what the hell? Like, Pancho is a nickname for Francisco, not from Ricardo. You know, but again, that Pancho was a, you know, considered a kind of racial, you know, term.
Because of Pancho Villa, right? Because
that's right. That, exactly. And that Pancho Villa gets actually not only, you know, assigned to Pancho, but to other athletes. You could write a whole thing on the many Pancho nicknames that are given to athletes from Mexican descent, right? But definitely, I think that was one of the things that he basically got his aggression out in the court. And he was a warrior on the court. You know, a great documentary that I encourage everybody to watch is Warrior on the Court, Pancho Gonzalez. That really goes into that history of how, you know, he essentially, you know, won back-to-back U.S. Open titles, and yet we don't talk about that, right, in 48 and 49, before, you know, the Open era, you know. And I think he could have won more Grand Slams if he was given the opportunity to play in Grand Slams, but at that time he was not allowed, right, because that was only for amateur players. And the thing is, he couldn't feed his family and continue to play amateur. Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a young family, so he had to go professional. But then he was barred from playing, you know, Grand Slam tournaments. And so I think because of Pancho, honestly, he encouraged me to play. So I really began to, you know, learn tennis. And in fact, I'm still playing tennis recreationally through the USTA, because what Pancho did in learning his story was inspiring me. And I hope many other, you know, Chicanos and Chicanas to play the sport, because I think that that's one of the sports that continues to be very predominantly white, and I would say white and black now, because, you know, with Serena and Venus and the Williams sisters, they have transformed that sport as well. Have a lot mm-hmm. more African Americans. But where are the Latinos? Where are the Latinos? You know, they're not there in the sport of tennis. So I think we need a huge campaign with the USTA to encourage more young Latinos and Latinas to play the sport, because I think it's amazing. Once you learn the fundamentals and you start early, because that's really key, is you have to start early.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest key. You had to start early. And that's why tennis has always been a very white sport. It was an elite sport. And then all the tennis players, you know, grew up playing it. All the white tennis players grew up playing it. They have coaches. They have all these resources.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone like the Williams sisters, you know, they were learning on their regular, right, you know, court at the park with their dad.
Right.
Pancho Gonzalez, he was learning in, you know, courts in the park.
Right.
I think that's the biggest thing, because there is you mentioned it in your book, there's a untapped talent market there of Mexicans who could play tennis. We just got to put the resources into the community. We'll have our own Serena and Venus Williams, you know?
That's right. That's right. And I think that, you know, often Pancho Gonzalez is not given enough credit for also opening doors for African Americans. You know, he was a mentor to Arthur Ashe when he was at UCLA. Okay. He would actually hit with him and he would encourage him to continue. You know, good friends with Althea Gibson, you know.
Okay.
And he was always about solidarity with his black tennis players. You know, he was very much about opening doors for Blacks in the sport of tennis. And even the Williams sister give a bunch of credit too, because, you know, again, he was opening doors early on for not just for Latinos, but for other non-white players. So I feel like Pancho needs to get his due, given more recognition, not only within the USTA, but also in, you know, I hope to one day maybe write his biography. We'll see. Because, you know, again, there's a lot of family members that I am in touch with, like Greg Gonzalez and others, who, you know, I'm trying to get, you know, his family members to, you know, to really write his story or to push, you know, the sport of tennis to really recognize him more, much more than, you know, he already is. And I'm glad that Cal State LA is named the tennis courts after Pancho Gonzalez and Rosy Casals there. So there is efforts to do that, at least in, you know, in at that level of college. But absolutely. I think more needs to be done professionally. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to whenever you maybe write that, because that is an important figure that people need to know about. All right. So I want to ask you about another important figure that I read in your book that I didn't know about. Was Margaret Marge Villa, who played in the, you know, the professional softball league that's famous from the movie A League of Their Own. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about her and the growth of baseball and softball with Mexican girls and women?
Yeah, you know, Marge Villa is a good friend that I got to meet. You know, I actually brought her to my campus. I didn't know about her story, and so I started to read Mario Longoria. He wrote a book on football players, and then he wrote an essay a while back on like the Latinas in the All American, you know, girls professional baseball league. And I'm like, you mean a league of their own? Yeah. You watch the movie, right? You would never know they were Latinas, right? Because there is no mention of them, right?
All they show is, you know, white players, maybe a Jewish player, and they have that one scene where they show the black lady.
That's right. Remember that one scene, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, where are the Latinas? It's like, wow. And then I've heard some like, well, you know, they were mostly Cuban, so you probably miss them if they showed them, because they were mostly, you know, light skin, passing, so you wouldn't mm-hmm. know they were Latinas or Cuban, right? Because, of course, they wouldn't give them any lines to read. So I'm yep. like, but come on, there had to be more than that. Well, yes, they were. They were Mexican-Americans that were also in the League of Their Own, yet you wouldn't know it by the film. But Marge Villa is one of those, right? She was a Mexican-American from Montebello, California, grew up playing with her brothers. Her brothers taught her the sport of baseball, but she was playing not just baseball, but softball. Early on, that was often the only opportunity, you know, joining softball teams. So she would play locally, but She basically went out for a tryout and they recruited her. But when she was going to go, it's like, oh, it's around wartime. So she delayed it by a few years. And so ultimately she joins the Kenosha Comets out in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And so this is really important, right? For a young girl, for her family to allow her, right, to travel across the country to play for the Kenosha Comets was huge. But she got a lot of family support, you know, from her brother and from her dad, and her mother was not big on her playing the sport, but the brothers, the men in the family were big advocates for her. And I think I've seen this as another pattern where when the brothers advocated for her, then they get the opportunity, right? So she was an important player because she was a catcher. She pitched. She was an all-around baseball player, an important leader. She at one point served as an interim coach when the coach couldn't do it. So to me, she was a leader on the diamond. And she continued to be a leader because they would have these exhibition games in Latin America, right? Well, guess who would be translating and interpreting for the team? Marge Villa, because she knew how to speak Spanish. So she talks about how she enjoyed being kind of an ambassador to young Latinas in Latin America, right? Encouraging them to take on the sport. And so I think that story is important because, you know, the diaspora is not limited to a male experience. It's also females were involved in the diaspora, that they were also athletes, although they were limited in terms of how much they could travel, right? Given the fact that they may not have an opportunity or money, right, enough to travel. But for Marge, yeah, it was an all expense paid for her to go to Latin America and promote the sport of baseball for women. So I think her history is important to learn, you know, not just the Penny Marshall film.
Yeah, and I was glad to read that she was also inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame along with the other
That's right.
women from the professional league. And also reading this and reading about that previous book that you contributed with your colleagues of Inland Empire Baseball and reading about Carmen Lujan too, mm-hmm. and the Smithsonian, like, it's very cool to read about the impact that women had with baseball in our community, because their stories aren't told compared to the men. Even when we already have a limited history told when it comes to our men as well, like, mm-hmm. you know, the women's story in sports for Mexican women is pretty much, you know, nobody knows about it. And so I'm glad that you wrote a book that talks about some of these people, some of these women.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, let me tell you.
Yeah, I'm sure it was hard to find information.
It was, because, you know, again, there's very little written about the women in sports, right? If you're using sports page as your source, good luck. You can't do that. You have to go where they are, and you have to do the interviews with them. And I think that's why I think this project took a lot longer than I anticipated. But it was well worth it to wait and to take my time. I think getting to know the woman who played the sport was just as enriching and pleasurable as writing it. And so it wasn't just Marge Villa, but it was, you know, getting to meet and talk about, you know, Amy Peralta from Arizona, you know, also Ernestine Navarro Hosaki, Ernie, she's my good friend from Oxnard. You know, Aggie Trejo was another one. Many young women who locally in Southern California, but also in the Southwest, right, played a huge role in the sport of softball. And yet, we don't know enough about their story. And I think we need to know more about their history, because one of the interesting findings that I had in researching their history is that they integrated many of these teams much early on than male teams. Because remember that a lot of softball teams, you know, they were very limited in terms of where they could play and how many they were. And so because they were fewer in number, in many ways, it kind of almost inadvertently allowed them to integrate early on. So you had, you know, many of them playing with, you know, Black woman players, Jewish players, Mexican players, and you had even Japanese American players, right? Even playing within a team, right? And that was unusual for that period of the 30s and 40s. You didn't really see that with the men, softball teams. Or the baseball team, right? Not so much. So again, that's a lesson for us to teach us about integration. If we allow women to become the leaders, right, in terms of athletics, but also maybe in politics and other areas of life, you know, we might see much more progress.
Yep. All right. So I want to segue to a different question topic. But can you tell me about the Good Neighbor Policy and the Office of Inter-American Affairs?
It was an interesting chapter because I didn't anticipate that during World War II that sports would be a thing, right? That in fact we even factor in because you have a war going on, right, in World War II. And, you know, then you have this policy, this sort of U.S. foreign policy program that started earlier before World War II with Roosevelt, right? The Good Neighbor Policy Program. That was really, you know, about becoming a friend of Latin America, right? But really, it was propaganda, right? I mean, think about it. Mm-hmm. Like, we want to make sure that Latin America stayed within our own backyard, but they also would do what we say, right? Meaning that when it came to war, they would be our allies. Well, in South America, that was a question mark. But in Mexico, you know, even in Mexico, it was still a question, right? In the sense that, you know, we want to make sure Mexico is, you know, closely aligned with our positions on foreign policy, but also when it came to war, right? So they created this Office of Inter-American Affairs. And we know about this because we know that Disney did all these films, right? As propaganda films, right, to Latin America. Like, what was that one? Hola Amigos? It was this one Disney film that was, like, promoted all throughout Latin America, right? That basically was saying, you know, you do great if you join the U.S. war effort to fight against the Nazis, right? And again, we know about the Hollywood's role in the Good Neighbor Policy, but we don't know the role of sports.
Yeah.
But, and so there was a sports office that was created within the Office of Inter-American Affairs. And it was in this office that we see certain sports that were being promoted. And so they enlisted the professional, amateur, and collegiate organizations. You know, so you have, for example, football coaches that are recruited from college universities to then go these coaching missions to Mexico to teach the Mexicans how to play American style football, right? And then you had also not just American football, you also had them, you know, you had these like goodwill sporting tournaments that were being promoted. You know, they were actually paid for bringing in athletes from Latin America, and they would compete in the U.S. But also we would send athletes here in the U.S. to Latin America to also kind of play in exhibition games, right? So you had these interesting, like, diplomatic sporting matches that were happening during the war. And it was really around the 1941 where it was really, you saw a lot of that happening, 42 and then 43. So, but as the war dragged on, then you really saw it kind of, being scaled back, you know, because they didn't want to create enemies. You know, there's a nice balance between, okay, you know, when you compete, when the U.S. is competing in a lot of these sports, they're much more well equipped, right? They're, you know, have great coaches, and they're going to, of course, defeat, right, these countries in certain sports, but you don't want to, you know, create enemies out of that, right? So there was this whole debate about, well, it's a fine line, right? Of like, there are these friendly matches, but, you know, but for the Latin Americans, like, we want to defeat the U.S.
Yep.
So especially in the sport of soccer, right? So we definitely saw.
I was going to ask you about that. So good thing you're segueing into that.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, with soccer but even in other sports, right? They were always like playing to defeat the U.S. and like to get one on the Yankee, right? So they became really contested battles, right? Even though it was wartime, right? They were still very much contested.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. You talk about soccer, how the U.S. government did not want them to have coaches or whatever teaching them or playing more soccer because they thought soccer as like the sport of socialism and that it would pretty much make the Mexicans hate America and go anti-American, even though they already were using sports for that.
Yep.
Which this week, you know, we just had Mexico and U.S. playing soccer. And that's always, I think, I know I go for Mexico, but it's bigger than soccer. It's bigger than sports. It goes into politics. You see a U.S., you see the Americans, like, you know, they're the enemy. They're the, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the colonizers, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting how they, let's not play soccer. That's socialist.
It's not only socialist, it's an immigrant thing, right? There's a lot of anti-soccer xenophobia early on. You know, they don't want to bring in, you know, socialism. They don't want to bring in immigrants that are bringing in soccer, you know. And of course, there is this kind of reluctance, right, to even bring up soccer in its goodwill tours. But eventually, you know, it does happen where, you know, in certain, like in the Northeast, right, there were some soccer teams that were like, yeah, we'll bring in Club Atlante, right, from Mexico. Okay. Let's play a match. You know, of course, Club Atlante is going to defeat them, right? They're much more competitive. And, you know, when they win in symbolic ways, right? Because at least they could defeat them in soccer. And I think that that's one of the things is that when we think about the history of sports in the U.S., soccer has never been a priority, right? But only in certain cities, right? In certain pockets, like mm-hmm. St. Louis, the Northeast. In L.A., it was a little bit uniquely different in the sense that you didn't have soccer being a huge sports within the Latino community. I mean, not in the same way that it was like in boxing or baseball, right? They created teams early on, but they didn't last a long time. So like in the late 20s, they created a team. In the 30s, the Aztec soccer team. It doesn't really pick up though. I mean, part of the challenge was that, you know, there weren't enough interest yet among the Mexican community in soccer. Why? Well, when we think about who were the Mexican community, they were coming from, you know, regions of Mexico where soccer was not huge. Remember, soccer was more centrally located within, you know, Mexico City or Guadalajara, right? Those were the two bigger soccer cities in Mexico.
A lot of the people are coming from the northern Mexico, the border towns.
Yeah. Exactly. They're not coming in from these soccer cities with that sport, right? And then creating leagues here. Or teams that comes in later, you know, so in the late 40s, well, after World War II, about the 40s, then we see soccer picking up in LA, Southern California, but that is much more marginal of a sport in Southern California. So people don't know that was the case early on. And again, more research needs to be done on the history of soccer in LA area, just because there's just more stories around these different teams that emerge.
Yeah, which now is totally different, you know.
Very different.
Soccer is, you know, huge here in the Mexican-American Chicano community, especially with a lot of people, you know, immigrating from Mexico. You know, I didn't play soccer, but my brothers did. It's because I have a disability, so I wasn't really into soccer, like baseball and basketball more. So I didn't like using my foot, but I remember going to all the games. But this is now, and it's, you know, now it's popular.
I really predict that, you know, a future Leo Messi is going to come from these ligas in the park where you see a lot of talent, right? And that's the thing, is we need to nurture that athletic talent in these, like, parks where we see them play, you know.
Yeah, I think that's another issue with when it comes to U.S. soccer team. You know, you guys have a lot of Mexican-Americans and Central Americans in the U.S. that could play on your team and make your team good. But for some reason, you know, they don't go and recruit Mexican or Central American players. It's all, you know, more elite white players that play on the national
team. Exactly, because of the play-to-play, right, system. You know, when we and this is why I think we need to bring this issue of racial equity into the soccer world. I mean, we need to kind of address the historic racist discrimination against Latin American players, because there has been an anti-Latino bias and racism in the sport of soccer when we look back to the 70s and 60s. But even back in the early period when they didn't allow more than one Latino soccer team to emerge out of the LA Soccer League Association, because we can't have too many Latino soccer teams. You can only allow one, right? That's discrimination. So they had to then create their alternative soccer leagues. So there's a long history of racism in the sport of soccer that we need to learn about. And if we don't do that, then how are we going to bring in equity, right, into this industry that really needs it right now? Because if they're looking for future talent, they need to reckon with the past first and then address the equity issue by starting to then recruit and channel resources into this future, you know, athletic soccer talent that we have among our midst. And I just think that the soccer federation needs to do more.
I agree. It's like kind of when we're talking about tennis and basketball and not getting the resources there, but you would think they would put it into soccer because it's so popular within our community.
Yeah.
All right. So about to end of the podcast very soon, or the interview. I wanted to ask you about the importance of Mexican sports journalism when it came to the making of the sporting Mexican diaspora that you talk about in your book as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think sports journalism is another important finding. I think from writing this book, I didn't think about how significant it was in the making of the sporting diaspora, but it's huge. Without sports journalism, you couldn't really have, well, first, I wouldn't be able to write this book because all these journalists left all these great articles for me to then use. But I think it's about also promoting the sport. It's about promoting the athletes. It's about also allowing these athletes, right, for more ways to make a living, right? Because if it wasn't for journalism, how are they going to make a living, right? How are they going to get the next match, right? How are they going to get higher pay, right, for barnstorming across the country for a team that's trying to recruit them, right? How are they going to then really leverage, right, their athletic talent, right, to be able to survive but also make money for their family and their community, right? So I think that sports journalism plays a huge role. And I look to the founding of the Mexican Sports Association as one of those sort of important organizations that emerges out of Southern California. And this is a group of journalists, right, that are writing for not only La Opinión newspaper, but many other newspapers. And then they're also writing for Mexico, right, because they're actually writing for Mexico City newspapers like Universidad, Excelsior. God, there's so many other newspapers that were really relying on these stories from LA-based journalists, right? And so there was a transnational journalistic network that they were also tapping into to be able to get their words out. And then you also had, you know, many of them that become not just journalists, right, but they become promoters or matchmakers. And then some of you become like editors and publishers of their own sports newspaper, like the Sports Page, you know, it's one of the examples that I use to show that there is this great opportunity, right, to increase the pipeline of more Latino sports journalists. You know, where are they? Because it's really sad when I look at the numbers of how few sports journalists they are even today.
Yeah, and it's how it was very important that these journalists become like the transnational voices for Mexicans in Mexico and Mexico de afuera, you know, in the U.S. So it was really cool to read the history of La Opinión, the sports page from Manuel Midget Martinez and all these other sports writers who really, really helped to shape this Mexican sporting diaspora.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I think Mitch Martinez is just one of many, right? And you have, you know, like Luis Magaña, right? Nobody knows his story, but he's an important boxing, you know, journalist in the sport of boxing, but he becomes a matchmaker for Olympic Auditorium.
Okay.
Hab Navarro is another one. I mean, there's so many, many journalists that really need to be recognized for their contribution for the development of the sporting diaspora. But also, I just hope that, you know, many of them learn their story so that they can really be encouraged to go on to that profession. And, you know, because I think that there's just very few, when we think about, you know, Latino sports reporters, we'd have very few and far between. So I think that recognition needs to happen so that we can then encourage more to enter that profession, right, of sports journalism.
All right, last question before we end the interview. Can you tell me a little bit about the Latino Sports History Project, I believe that's what it's called, right? That you and a few colleagues are a part of?
Yeah. So the Latino Baseball History Project.
Okay, that's what it's called.
Yeah, the Latino Baseball History Project. So it's a group of, you know, baseball historians, but just fans, right? And aficionados, people who just love the sport. We formed this network that basically is really about recovering and documenting the contributions of Latinos and Latinas in the sport of baseball, right? And we've done a lot of different kinds of events, like from player reunions, book signings, where we produce a whole series of Mexican-American baseball books, which are out of, you know, first our Arcadia, but now we're independently publishing them. And so Richard Santillan, sort of the brains behind this operation, because he's the one that has really taken it to the next level and really trying to get more, recognition about that rich history, you know, and we're really following really the history of the Negro Leagues Museum and documentation projects.
Because
that's really, you know, when you think about the Negro League Museum in Kansas City and many of the stories of the Negro League players, right, we're following in that tradition. And we're actually going to be contributing to the exhibition at the Smithsonian, right, that's coming out, the Play Ball exhibition that's opening this summer. You can see a lot of the products of the and efforts that we've done. We've helped the Smithsonian recover a lot of those stories and photographs and objects. So you can see that at the Smithsonian that's opening up at the National Museum of American History. So you got to check out the exhibit. And it's going to be a traveling exhibition too. So you could bring it to
Brooklyn. Okay. Oh, yeah. And I saw a photo that Mark posted on Twitter a couple of years ago. And they were going to donate Carmen Luján's Colton Mercury Señoritas jersey to the Smithsonian.
Yeah. I was there when Carmen, donated it at the. So the exhibition has an archive at the Cal State San Bernardino campus.
Yeah. Which really made me happy because I'm from Colton and I'm also an alumni from Cal State San Bernardino besides San Jose State. That's where I went for undergrad was Cal State San Bernardino. So learning about that really made me really happy since I'm from there and I went to school there. So now I'm very excited and I want to go back and visit the library and try to see if I could look at
stuff. You have to. They have a huge collection there. And so this is where, A lot of the efforts have gone to putting together and growing the archive. But I think Richard is working on, a book on, you know, South Bay in LA, Belvedere, East LA. I mean, you name it. I think he's expanding to Texas and Arizona now and other states in the Southwest. So I think there is this sort of movement now of other states wanting to kind of recover their history as well. So hopefully it'll continue. And we really need, you know, not only exhibitions, but now we need a documentarian. We need a documentary, maybe a script for a Netflix series. I don't know. You name it.
I'm like, I know some filmmakers, so.
Well, pass on and I'll forward to Richard because we definitely need to, you know, make visible these stories, right? From Colton, from San Bernardino, from Oxnard, from all these small towns. And I mean, there's just great, rich local stories that need to be highlighted, you know, so.
I'm really looking forward to that exhibit. Guess I'm going to have to do a trip and go visit it before it travels, you know.
Yeah, well, it will still be going. So I think you'll have time because with COVID,
awesome.
It pushed back the opening dates. And so we may.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's still time.
All right. That's all right. Awesome. Thank you for coming on the podcast. We'll end it here.
Thank you, Miguel.
It was awesome talking to you, Dr. Jose Alamillo. If you want, before we go, you can plug in whatever you want, your book, where people can find you and read your research if you want.
Yeah, just type in Deportes and you might get a hit, or you might get Deportes, ESPN Deportes. but yeah, definitely check it out. But also check out the Playbill exhibition that's opening at the Smithsonian this summer. I hope to hopefully be there. We'll see with COVID restrictions. I'm not sure, but I know one of these days I'll get there. But yeah, I think there's a lot happening around Latinos in sports. So. Thank you, Miguel, for having me and for joining your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It was awesome. Again, you can read his book, Deportes, The Making of a Sporting Mexican Diaspora by Dr. Jose Alamillo. Stay tuned after this interview for this week's Molotov MVP and Chicano Sports History segment. I think for Molotov MVP, I'm going to feature Richard Pancho Gonzalez. Not sure about Chicano sports history yet because there's so many to choose from. So I'm glad that you made this book because I'm going to use it as a resource. So thank you again, Dr. Jose Alamillo, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
Welcome to another Molotov MVP segment. Each episode, I honor people in sports who light that cocktail and toss it back at enemy lines, creating a spark. Episode 20's Molotov MVP is the legendary Mexican Chicano tennis superstar, Richard Pancho Gonzalez. El maestro de la raqueta, Ricardo Alonso Pancho Gonzalez, was born on May 9th, 1928 in Los Angeles, California. At the age of 12, his mother bought him a 51-cent racket, and he began to teach himself by watching players on the public courts at Exposition Park. Once he learned to play, he lost interest in school and was banned by the head of the Los Angeles Tennis Club, Perry Jones, because he had learned that Gonzalez quit school. At the age of 15, Richard was arrested for burglary and served a year in jail. He later joined the Navy at the end of World War II and received a bad conduct discharge in 1947. That's right, fuck the fucking government. Gonzalez was ranked number one in the world of tennis for 8 straight years from 1952 to 1960 and was in the top 10 for 21 consecutive years from 1948 to 1969. Gonzalez won 14 singles men's tennis titles and 13 professional Grand Slam titles. On September 19, 1948, Gonzalez shocked the tennis world when he defeated South Africa's Eric Sturgis to capture his first back-to-back U.S. national singles championships. The white-dominated tennis establishment called him a one-hit wonder, so Gonzalez won the title again in 1949. Gonzalez faced racism as a Mexican in a sport dominated by the white establishment. He felt like an outsider and constantly faced attacks by the American white media and had to defend himself against racist and gender constructions that he was the bad boy of tennis. In Dr. Alamillo's book, he cites a quote from Gonzalez on the treatment he received from the media. Quote, "I read the write-ups. Every guy does, no matter how earnestly some might tell you that they don't. But ever since that time of my suspension for playing hooky, when some writers branded me as anything from a juvenile delinquent to public enemy number one, I stopped believing everything I read in the papers." End of quote. Thank you, Richard Pancho Gonzalez, for showing the world that Mexicans can be tennis superstars as well. You are Episode 20's Molotov MVP. We'll be right back.
I'm Jimmy Powers, bringing you another edition of my Press Box Favorites. Tennis is a game of surprises. Every so often, a youngster pops up overnight, and the sport has a new champion. How does he do it? Well, it's worth a moment of analysis. Those were great matches, and here's another worth looking at. The case of a kid named Pancho Gonzalez. The tennis world barely knew his name in 1948 when he galloped through the early rounds of the National Singles Championship at Forest Hills. But suddenly, we here in the press box were aware that this 20-year-old from the public courts of California was making a determined bid to take the title. Sturgis serves for match point. And Pancho takes it, receives his opponent's congratulations, and tennis has its youngest champion. Pancho had proved that he had the stuff to take the title. But it took another year and another match to prove he had the ingredients of a great champion, the ability to muster reserve strength when needed. The time was a year later. The place was that same center court at Forest Hills. The Westside Tennis Club is jammed as Ted Schroeder battles Pancho Gonzalez. Schroeder serves and Pancho strokes from the baseline in one of the most amazing matches in tennis history. Point to Gonzalez. Schroeder serves again. He takes the point. Pancho deals as they battle in the longest final round set in championship history. Schroeder wins it 18-16 and then takes the second stanza 6-2. Pancho is close to defeat. But he makes a determined rally, comes back to win the last three sets, 6-1, 6-2, 6-4, a great display of staying power. That's a close-up demonstration of how a champion is made. Pancho Gonzalez was able to pour on the power when it was needed. The difference between winning and losing was his strength in reserve. Champions and championship teams have it. This is Jimmy Powers, and I'll be coming your way soon with more thrilling sports stories, my press box favorites.
Welcome to another segment of Chicano-Chicana Sports History. Today I want to highlight a legendary Chicana labor organizer and teacher, Emma Tenayuca. The San Antonio-born communist indigenous Mexicana was a labor organizer and teacher, and a legendary basketball player. Emma Tenayuca was born to a Comanche Mexican family on December 21st, 1916 in San Antonio, Texas. At an early age, her grandfather would take Emma to protest rallies, and she quickly took an interest in political activism. The Great Depression also impacted Emma and her family, and Emma loved to visit the Plaza de Zacate, where families and unemployed workers would meet. Additionally, socialists would give speeches at the plaza on the plight of the workers. Emma became a community organizer as a teenager and at the age of 16 was arrested for the first time when she joined picketing workers in a strike against the Fink Cigar Company. However, Emma Tenayuca became known as a legendary labor organizer shortly after joining the Communist Party USA in 1936 and founding the San Antonio chapter of the Workers' Alliance of America. On January 31, 1938, Emma led a successful strike of 12,000 Mexican women pecan shellers against wage cuts from the Southern Pecan Shelling Company. The strike lasted for 37 days until March 8th when they reached arbitration. The pecan shellers received a wage increase of 25 cents per hour. However, Emma was not just a legend off the court, but on the court as well. Emma Thanayuka was a standout San Antonio High School basketball player and was a point guard for the Modern Maids Club of the Spanish American Women's Basketball League from 1932 to 1934. Emma was selected to the 1933 All-City Girls Basketball Team and played baseball for the Spanish American Baseball League as well. Sports helped Emma Thanayuka learn strong leadership skills that would serve her well as a labor organizer. Thank you to La Pasionera de Texas, Emma Thanayuka, for showing how sports is a weapon for political change. After this segment, I'm playing a song called Emma Thanayuka, La Pasionera de Texas, from the Sacramento-based Spanglish surf punk band La Pulgas. Check them out on Bandcamp. Thank you for listening to another Chicano Sports History segment. Wrap up the podcast. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Sports as a Weapon podcast.